Well, hello, Steelers. What a time to be alive. Isn't it great that we can continue to meet over the internet and connect with each other, even though we're physically not with each other? In a way, that kind of makes every service a satellite service. So welcome, everyone, to the satellite service. Of course, we look forward to meeting again in person and being together again. I mean, those family Sunday meals were extremely tasty. But we're carrying on with these measures in the hopes that we can meet again sooner than later. I can remember early on in this crisis, we met as a staff team to talk about how we're going to tackle this crisis. And we came up with a three-phase response and determined to pay attention and adjust the plan if needed. The next day, we had moved to phase three. Things were moving fast, and things were moving fast all over the world. Things were changing daily, and some of these measures may have seemed extreme, but they needed to be taken to take this crisis seriously. And I knew things were getting serious when Pearl Jam canceled their upcoming North American tour. I was thinking about all of these serious measures, and somehow I got to thinking about the show The Walking Dead. It's a zombie show, and the way that they explain zombies is that it's a virus that turns you into a zombie, and it's passed on when a zombie bites or scratches you. So there was one character on the show. Well, there were a lot of characters on the show that were bitten by zombies, but this one character on the show was bitten on the leg. And after some quick decision-making, he had his leg cut off to stop the zombie virus from spreading to the rest of his body. It was an extreme measure. He lost his leg, but he did whatever it took to stop the virus from spreading so that he didn't turn into a zombie. And that picture just stood out in my mind. Like, with all of these serious measures being taken, I got to wondering, how seriously do we take sin? Like, what extreme measures would you take to remove sin from your life? One of the ways that sin can be described is that of a virus. It spreads and infects and damages, and it always destroys. Theologian Scott McKnight describes sin as hyperrelational distortion. He says that sin damages in every way that humans have the ability to relate. So it destroys our ability to relate to God and the life that he gives. It destroys our self-image and our self-value. It isolates us from each other and the community that we all need. And it diminishes our roles as creation stewards. With the sin virus distorting and decimating God's good creation at every level, we can see why God would take sin so seriously. In a series of teachings that Jesus did called the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus made this profound statement on sin. It's found in Matthew 5, verses 29 to 30. It says, "If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell." Hey, whoa, Jesus. Tap the brakes here a little bit. You want me to do what when I stumble? Aren't we going a little 0 to 60 pretty quick here? I think it's pretty easy to get defensive at the outset of reading this passage. I mean, it's a pretty harsh teaching from Jesus. And when we're met with harsh teachings like this from Jesus, there's a tendency to want to take an easy way out. I think that Jesus needed to tell us about sin this way so that we could be shocked into seeing its seriousness. What Jesus is doing here is using an extreme word picture to get our attention. When we read this extreme word picture too literally, we miss out on the very practical position on sin that Jesus is taking. Jesus uses the word picture so that we could understand how bad sin is. It's like he's saying, listen, I want you to understand how bad sin really is. In fact, it would be better for you to cut off your hand than to go on sinning. I know that that sounds crazy, but if you could only see the damage that sin is doing inside of you, to your heart, to your soul, then you would cut your hand off in a second to stop it. The price you're paying for sin isn't worth your eye or your hand. Sin always seeks to destroy. So with the understanding of the corruptive nature of sin, we can begin to see what Jesus is asking the citizens of his kingdom to do. Jesus helps us to see the seriousness of sin so we can take the drastic measures to get rid of it in our lives. I don't think that Jesus is proposing that we start lopping off our limbs. One commentator framed it like this. The word picture is to employ deliberate, decisive action in dealing with our propensity to sin. But we don't always do that, do we? We have a way of cozying up to sin. We have a way of diminishing the seriousness of sin in our lives. Here are a couple of ways that we fail to see sin for what it really is. The first one is brought to us by the phrase, I'm a good person, at least I haven't, and insert comparatively worse action here. Stolen anything, done drugs, cheated on a test, and the grand poobah of all at least I haven't statements, at least I haven't murdered anyone. I was co-leading a church school class some time ago, and I loved these classes. They were probably some of the most profound teaching and discussion times that these students had. The discussion format allowed us to communicate and teach the biblical principles, but also allowed us to discuss the rabbit trail topics on biblical issues that the students were interested in. And during one class, we were having a discussion on something about along the lines of wrong and right, and a student that had gone to church all their lives uttered the infamous phrase, "I'm a good person, at least I haven't murdered anyone." It became a great launching point to teach the whole class on the true nature of the gospel, that we're all sinners in need of grace. I made my case and stated that we're actually all bad people, including myself, sinners before God. The student was so offended that I pointed out this biblical truth that they didn't speak to me for 6 months. Even Christians are offended by the gospel. The problem with the "at least I haven't" phrase is that you take a sin that you haven't done and make it the worst thing. And then you excuse all the other sins that you've committed against God and his good creation. You end up giving sin a grading system. These sins are really bad. Try to steer clear of these ones. These ones are okay or excusable because at least they're not really hurting anyone. Another way that sin gets described is that it's missing the mark. In essence, it's failing to live up to the standards that God set. When you adopt the "I'm a good person, at least I haven't" mentality, you're essentially missing the mark and then trying to draw the bullseye around it. But how does God see sin? What is his grading system? There's a passage in Proverbs that gives us some insight into God's perspective on sin. It's found in Proverbs 6, verses 16 to 19. It says, "There are six things the Lord hates, seven that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are quick to rush into evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a person who stirs up conflict in the community." What I find interesting about that list is that God detests lying as much as he does murder. Murder and lying get the same grade. I'm certain that in one way or another, I've done everything on that list but murder someone. Don't worry, I'm not looking to complete the checklist. So while I may not have murdered anybody, I'm still a bad person. I've contributed to the destruction of God's good creation. We're so quick to excuse certain sins that we think are less harmful than others. And God's over here going, I hate it all. When you adopt the I'm a good person, at least I haven't mentality, you're positioning yourself to be unteachable by God. Our goal and our aim should be that of posturing ourselves as learners before God. We should be seeking to take on God's perspective on life and how to live it. If you're too busy setting the standards for sin for yourself, then God can't show you the areas of sin in your life that he wants you to work on, which overall is the sin of pride, which at his heart is putting yourself before God. I think that people are unsettled by the fact that they are not in control of what constitutes as good and bad behavior, or even by the attitude that God has towards sin. I love how Francis Chan responds to this in his book, Crazy Love. He says, God is the only being who is good, and the standards are set by him. Because God hates sin, he has to punish those guilty of sin. Maybe that's not an appealing standard, but to put it bluntly, when you get your own universe, you can make your own standards. None of us have made a universe of any sorts, but God has made this universe in its entirety. We don't set the standards, God does. And those are the standards that we should be striving for. So, adopting God's view in this regard is to see all sin as equally destructive to God's good creation. The next way that we fail to see sin for what it really is by doing what I call loopholing. This is where you take an action prohibited by God, a sin, and try to get as close to that action as possible without actually doing that action. It's like drawing a line and everything before that line is fine and everything after that line is sin. And you try to get as close to that line without crossing it. In this scenario, you're actually more preoccupied with sin than you are with loving God and his way of life. The Jews in Jesus' day had become adept at being loopholers. An example of one of the lines that they tiptoed toward was around interest for loans. Exodus prohibited the profiting off of loans given out to fellow Israelites by charging interest. God did this so that the poor and the needy wouldn't be trapped in endless loan repayments. But the Jews of Jesus' day found a way around that. The law only extended to Jews. So the way that the Jews would profit off of lending to fellow Jews was to introduce a third-party non-Jew. So now the Jewish moneylender could charge the non-Jew interest and in turn pass that along to the Jewish moneylender's fellow Jew. God intended this law to be good and to bring out the kingdom principle of love thy neighbor. And the Jews of Jesus' day took that as an invitation to tiptoe toward that sin line. Jesus' response to this is found in his Mount Sermon series in Matthew 6, verse 33. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Jesus is saying, forget moving towards the line. That kind of living doesn't bring anything good in your life. Instead, your primary focus should be on living in God's kingdom and what God says is good. And then you'll see a way to live life the way it was meant to be lived. I want to take a look at one last way that we fail to see sin seriously. And this would be to hold a cultural view of sin. Right now, our cultural's response to sin is to tolerate it. Or even further than that, it has become popular to say that there is no wrong. If you want to be that, do that, say that, it's okay, you do you. And to challenge someone on their definition of what is right or what they feel to be right will be immediately labeled as intolerant. Defining what is objectively true has become taboo. Defining truth is left up to the individual, and everyone has to be okay with that. Josh and Sean McDowell wrote a book called The Beauty of Intolerance, and in it they make the case for universal moral truth. They make this observation on how tolerance is viewed in our culture today. Cultural tolerance does not simply require that we give others the freedom to believe or live differently than we do. It has evolved into a demand that we accept, respect, and affirm the rightness of others' views and behavior, or be labeled intolerant, bigoted, or even hateful. But this view is a total lie, because the tolerance only goes so far. It only goes as far as agreeing with what is tolerated. Cultural tolerance is only tolerated as long as no one is intolerant. Intolerance is not tolerated. But in order to be tolerant, and by definition, allowing all differences to stand, you need to tolerate intolerance. So it can't stand as a logical line of reasoning. The law of non-contradiction states that two opposing views or statements cannot be both true at the same time. If you have in mind to punch me in the face as being true, I would view that as incorrect. I would be completely intolerant before that, or completely intolerant toward that view, which, if you currently hold that view, I'm quite thankful for social distancing right now. And according to God, sin cannot be both life-giving to his good creation and devastating to it. Again, in The Beauty of Intolerance, Sean and Josh McDowell make this statement on God's view of sin. God's hatred of evil and injustice, of everything that hurts us, prompted him to be radically intolerant of sin and its devastating effects on his creation. That something cost him the death of his only son, but he considered you and me worth it. God's intolerance is an amazing and beautiful thing. Today is the day that we celebrate that God dealt with sin once and for all. God couldn't stand sin in our lives, and he knew that we couldn't fix the sin problem that we created for ourselves. He put the punishment and the consequence that we deserved for our rebellion against him on Jesus, and we took on Jesus' righteousness. What Jesus did on the cross shows us how intolerant God is towards sin. Today is the day that we celebrate that God administered his vaccine for sin, Christ's loving and sacrificial death on the cross on our behalf. Taking on Christ's righteousness repairs our relationship with God when we ask for his forgiveness. And when that relationship is restored, our transformation truly begins, and every relationship follows, begins to fall in line. Romans 12, verse 2 says, "Do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." Having a restorative relationship with God allows you to reshape your perspective, to see things the way that God sees them. And when you see the serious nature of sin the way that God sees it, you can make the choices to distance yourself from those actions that diminish God's good creation. And distancing yourself from sin might feel like losing a body part. Maybe you have friends or are in a relationship or have family members that are distracting you from your life-giving relationship with God. Find a community that points you to God. Maybe you can't be alone with a computer or a smartphone, and you'd have to place limitations on that. That can feel like losing a body part. Maybe your pride is standing in the way of forgiveness, and your heart is growing more and more bitter towards someone who needs your forgiveness. Whatever it is, ask God to show you where there is sin in your life, and then take that prompting seriously by working to remove it. Let's pray. God of love and mercy, thank you for your work in redeeming and giving us your gift of peace in the death and resurrection of Jesus. Show us where our lives don't line up with your good, pleasing, and perfect will, and give us the strength to align our perspectives with yours. Amen. May the God of love teach you how to live in his love and in his life. Be safe, be healthy, and may God bless you in this time, and we'll see you online.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they nailed him to the tree? Were you there when they nailed him to the tree? Sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. Were you there when they nailed him to the tree? Were you there when they laid him in the tomb? Were you there when they laid him in the tomb? Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. Were you